The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Karen Duffy is titled Think Like a Bear and Other Life Lessons Discovered in Unexpected Places. Be true to yourself, even when it's really difficult, Karen Duffy. Yes, the former MTV VJ advises her cub, or son. In this letter to him from her new book, Wise Up, Irreverent Enlightenment from a Mother Who's Been Through It, she shares lessons on how to do just that, which she learned from her own challenging times, including being diagnosed with an incurable neurological disease and from some hard-partying bears. Dear Cub, the Romani community of Bulgaria trained bears to dance for hundreds of years, a medieval tradition that lived on as a modern vestige of the Dark Ages. These were brown bears, Ursus arctos, known in North America as the fierce grizzly bear. They were plied with booze by their trainers, and they performed their infamous dances while schnockered. In 2007, Bulgaria was admitted to the European Union. Part of the price of admission was banning all dancing bear acts, which were rightfully deemed cruel and inhumane. The retired dancing bears were moved to a special refuge. The team at the bear sanctuary had a specialized task of teaching bears to be bears, how to hibernate, how to hunt, how to have bear sexy time. Food was hidden around the sanctuary to reawaken the foraging instinct that had been trained out of them. The Dancing Bear Park became an ursine experiment in freedom. The sanctuary staff has had great success, but sometimes the bears struggle with the chaos of free will. The difficulty of making their own choices causes pain. At these times, the bears revert to the behavior that the rehabilitation staff were trying to get them to unlearn. When they see a human, they get up on their hind legs and dance a jig. Free will is a challenge, not just for retired dancing bears, but for all of us. When we're scared or threatened, we can fall back on bad habits. We don't sit up on our haunches and twirl, at least most of us don't, but we make bad choices, go along with ideas and plans we don't believe in, and close ourselves off to experience. Relying on unhelpful pattern responses lets laziness imprison us. We all have a key to our own cages. Reading and educating yourself is a way to pick the lock. The only person standing between you and freedom is you. You are the boss of you. There is no one tethering you or muzzling you or making you dance the tarantella. You've always been mostly a perfect child, which has been sort of annoying. But I did notice that when we were shut up in quarantine, you stopped doing laundry and went back to your old habit of letting your dirty boxers pile up in the middle of the floor. Jack, as a young man, you're experiencing greater and greater freedom. With greater freedom comes the challenge of greater responsibility. This is why you need a philosophy of life. A life philosophy is not only about big existential questions, such as how do I live a good life, why are we here, and who thought it was a good idea to give 1,000-pound bears booze and make them shake their hindquarters. A life philosophy is an attitude. It is your vision for your life. It is the direction you want to go. It is what you do with your freedom. It is your purpose. It is a framework to help you make choices. It is the wisdom you'll refer to as you navigate the next 8 decades. The Stoic philosopher Epictetus, one of the wisest and wittiest teachers who has ever drawn a breath, observed that everyone faces challenges and that a good life is within the grasp of all of us. He was born a slave, was savagely beaten by his master, and endured chronic pain and disability, yet he became a revered teacher. I feel a deep connection to his wisdom. The simplicity and clarity of his ideology is transcendent. If your choices are beautiful, so too will you be. Your life is a perishable good. Choose to squeeze what you can out of everyday life. Life is magnificent, then just okay, then amazing, then it is hard and sucks a bit. But in between the awesome and the suck is the daily duty of living. Marvel at the awesome, and when it stinks, find a way to laugh. This is your life, challenging, funny, and ordinary. The more it sucks, the more you need to suck in the amazing moments. Inhale, take it in. Honor your 40 trillion cells that make you, you. You are buzzing with life force, but we all need help in navigating the complexities of being a human. Your philosophy for life is your operating manual. It will guide you through concrete questions such as, what should I study in college? How do I apologize after I screw up? And how much should I duke the waiter? At the very least, 20%. You are descended from a long lineage of good tippers. Answering these questions will help you answer the bigger ones, like, what can I do to be of service? How can I be a good person? How can I live a meaningful life? Philosophy in Greek means love of wisdom. Wisdom is the ability to thrive in a complex world and make thoughtful, generous, and insightful decisions. The choices you make in everyday life are guided by your philosophy. Every day that you don't get up on your hind legs and dance like a Bulgarian bear is a win. The wisdom you need to follow your own path is readily available to you. As Epictetus once said, it is all up to you and your way of thinking. I endured years of fertility treatments to have you. Don't be a helpless sack of organs. Mum. Our next article by Sylvia Vasquez Lovato is titled, I Risked My Life to Get It Back. This essay does contain mentions of sexual assault. I was clutching an oxygen tank in a devastating blizzard, cut off from my team. Death was a real possibility. I'd been in danger before, but this time was different. I have climbed the tallest mountain on every continent. I have learned to climb to places so extreme there is barely enough oxygen to sustain life. By definition, I'm a badass, a conqueror, an extreme athlete, a survivor. I always thought surviving meant never being vulnerable again, never being small or weak. Weakness was the enemy, the gateway drug to being abused. And so I constructed an armor around my heart, my body, and my soul, and kept a vigilant watch to make sure no person and no thing ever got close enough to hurt me. When experience has muddied the difference between friends and foes, it's safest to assume everyone is foe. When I was 6 years old, a family friend told me that the things he did to me when no one was watching were things my parents wanted to happen. I lost so much more than my innocence and trust in the adults around me. I lost trust in myself. I lost the ability to say no, to understand my own boundaries, and to discern what and who was safe. In my experience, trauma survivors are often the most extreme risk takers because it's not hard to live on the edge of safety if nothing looks safe. When I left Peru to go to the United States on a partial scholarship for college, I thought I could outrun, outwork, and outdrink the trauma I carried with me. I didn't have a language for trauma, but I had a word for vulnerability. I called it weakness. I was on a trip back home to Peru, trying to recover from unsuccessfully outdrinking my trauma, when I had a vision about mountains during an Amazonian Ayushka ceremony. Ayushka was my very Catholic mother's idea, via the only doctor in the family who had done his medical residency in the Amazon, in the small city of Tarapoto. I participated in the Ayushka ceremony with my parents, and I trusted the vision in a way I had never trusted any decision prior. At that moment, I vowed to become a mountain climber. And I did, summiting peak after peak with Everest always ahead of me. It's tough to climb at extreme altitudes, but I learned that mountains don't ask for grit and grind. They ask for humility and respect and honesty. You can't lie to a mountain. You can't hide weakness or inexperience. They are life-threatening. Halfway through my mountaineering journey, after a bitter night on Mount Aconcagua in Argentina, I realized I needed to get others with me so they could also lay their biggest pain at the feet of the biggest mountain. Just summiting wasn't my calling. Sharing the wisdom of the mountains with other sexual assault survivors was. I started Courageous Girls, a nonprofit that helps the victims of sexual assault recover through climbing. I became someone who brought my biggest pain to the biggest mountain, and when I first looked up from the base and saw Mount Everest, or Kamalungma as the Tibetans call it, I experienced awe. I had never been in the presence of something bigger than my own pain. Yet Evers broke my heart open, and I knew that the mother of the world, as the Nepalese and Tibetans call her, wasn't made for conquering. She was made for surrender. And I couldn't have made it to the top of Mount Everest without acknowledging what I had spent a lifetime denying. I am strongest when I am most vulnerable. It was the opposite of the lessons I had learned from my sexual abuse as a child. On Mount Everest, after decades of self-destructive behavior and in the face of potential death, I learned I wanted to live, really wanted to live. I felt fear, and in that jolt of feeling, I knew that this was what I had been running from, the fragility of self, the fragility of body, the fragility of strength, the fragility of me. After a decade of climbing, I was close to Everest summit when I came out of that blizzard on the edge of defeat, clutching my oxygen tank and still feeling alone. It was then that a veteran climber told me that it was okay to be scared, that she got scared, that admitting fear doesn't make you a bad climber. But more importantly, I gave myself that permission. I was vulnerable, and that was okay. I realized that some risks were worth taking, the risk to love others, to help others, the risk to love and help myself. Not everyone needs to go where the air is thin and they are gasping to breathe to learn this, but some of us do. For those of us who never learned who and what was safe, those of us who had to leave our bodies to survive and then had no way to find our way back home to ourselves, sometimes we need to go to the extremes, to the edge of the edge, and peer over into the drop to realize that we don't want to fall. I have stood on that edge many times, teetering and choosing between survival and self-destruction. As survivors, we work to learn the difference. Today, I'm strong enough to climb the tallest mountains in the world and smart enough to know I'm even stronger when I climb with others. I am vulnerable because I am human. I am human because I am a survivor. I am a survivor because I am strong. I am strong because I am vulnerable. And how you survive a mountain is how you survive anything. One brave, sure step at a time. Our next article by Francesca Wade is titled, The Trailblazing Women Who Rewrote the History Books. Who makes history? Who writes it? And who features in it? Oprah Daily wants to honor women who have played roles outside the spotlight, grandmothers, resistance workers, and professors. We also are taking another look at figures we thought we knew, including the familiar faces of the Black Madonnas of France. One of the essays in this collection quotes Virginia Woolf, who said, "We look back through our mothers if we are women. Look back with us at the remarkable women who made our history." We look back through our mothers if we are women, Virginia Woolf insisted in her lecture, A Room of One's Own, originally delivered to a packed hall of women students at Cambridge University. Woolf urged her audience to go home and start to write about their lives, their friendships, their mothers and grandmothers. For centuries, Woolf argued, women had been deprived of knowing their history by historians who focused their research and narratives on the public deeds of great men. They failed to make room in their history books for the everyday activities of women, of no less importance and human interest than the stories of kings and battles. She argued that it's in our own power to create a history and tradition of subversive writing in which future generations might recognize themselves. Woolf connected her frustration with the way history is written to her experiences walking around her beloved city of London. She encountered at every turn statues of great bearded statesmen erected in celebration of their service to empire. In her essays and novels, she writes powerfully of the disconnect of trying to find her own voice in a city that makes clear in its very architecture that she isn't part of its story, and neither were the previous generations of women who might have offered her examples as she asked how she wanted to live. But there was one statue in London that Woolf loved. An anonymous woman kneeling down to pour water from an urn outside the gates of the Foundling Hospital on Guildford Street in Bloomsbury. The statue, unobtrusive and peaceful, suggested to Woolf an alternative hidden history waiting to be discovered. I would venture to guess that Anon, who wrote so many poems without signing them, was often a woman, she wrote. This idea became the basis of a book she was writing at the time of her death in 1941, an alternative history of England that would tell the story of Anonymous in English literature. Her plan was to lay bare the social forces that shape lives invisibly, giving some clear advantages and making life impossible for others of equal talent. This was the continuation of a theme central to A Room of One's Own, where Woolf conjured a fictional sister of William Shakespeare, a brilliant and ambitious young woman who was refused every opportunity given to her brother, eventually dying pregnant and unknown at a London crossroads. In the early part of the 20th century, women writers working across disciplines, from historiography to detective fiction, poetry to political philosophy, were exploding conventions of what women's history might look like. The poet Hilda Doolittle, known as H.D., was a devoted student of Greek literature. She imagined the voices of mythological heroines, Cassandra, Helen, Demeter, who had long been consigned to the role of muse, passive observers to their own stories. In H.D.'s extraordinary poetry, these women step out of the roles assigned to them and challenge their readers to imagine old tales from new perspectives. This project reached its greatest fulfillment in her fragmented epic Helen in Egypt, in which Helen of Troy embarks on a journey of psychoanalysis to reassemble the fragments of herself scattered in men's stories. H.D. was greatly inspired by the work of historian Jane Harrison, a pioneering scholar whose work shook the classical establishment to its core. Harrison suggested that behind the well-known male gods familiar from Greek tragedy and epic poetry lay a forgotten history of mother-goddess worship. Harrison argued that women had once served as leaders in cults dedicated to powerful female goddesses, whose shrines and legends were subsequently reattributed to male gods, as women's status in society was gradually eroded. Her meticulously researched work, drawing on cutting-edge discoveries from archaeological excavations ongoing across Greece and the Middle East, proved that women had been systematically written out of history. Harrison had a friend and devotee in Woolf who reread her work as she researched her own book. Woolf also recorded in her diary that she was rereading the work of economic historian Eileen Power, whose book Medieval People had been a surprise bestseller in publication in 1922. Power was rising through the ranks as a scholar of economic history at the prestigious London School of Economics. She was a stylish figure who enjoyed bewildering men by her ability to combine an interest in fashion with a deep academic rigor. One of the first works of social history, written at a time when few historians had thought to investigate the quotidian lives of women several centuries in the past, Power's books set out to tell the everyday stories of ordinary people. The nuns balancing their account books as they prepared a feast for a visiting abbot, the peasant farmer laboring in his field, the working mother snatching moments of respite while her children were at school. It was a vision of history focused not on great men, battles, and politics, but on culture, women, and communities. Its emphasis on peace and community was highly suggestive to Woolf, writing her own history in 1941 under the shadow of a second European war. A determination to rethink how history is written is not the only connection between Woolf, H.D., Harrison, and Power. Between the two world wars, each of them happened to live in Mecklenburg Square in London's Bloomsbury, a bohemian area known for its cheap rents, artistic neighbors, and proximity to the British Museum Reading Room, where anyone could sign up free of charge to use its unrivaled collection of books and manuscripts. Intrigued by this coincidence, I wove their biographies into my own book, Square Haunting, which takes its cue from Woolf's provocation in A Room of One's Own, to write the sort of history in which unknown women might find a sense of solidarity. In the square, these writers forged experimental, expansive lives, doing their best to establish domestic arrangements that would enable, rather than curtail, the intellectual freedom they all cherished. Each was determined to write about women as they had not been written about before. By changing the way we think about the past and radically re-examining whose stories are included in history, they have held up a mirror for the future so that women stretching boundaries in any field might know their forebears and hear them cheering us on. Our next article by Rebecca Donner is titled Uncovering the History of My Great-Great-Aunt's Nazi Resistance. When I was a girl, my grandmother gave me a book gone brittle with age. It was a volume of Shakespeare's sonnets. I gazed at the signature on the flyleaf, a flourish in dark ink, Mildred. She was my grandmother's aunt, my great-great-aunt. You remind me of her, my grandmother told me. Why, I wanted to know. My grandmother responded with a smile. Even in my child's eyes, her smile seemed wistful. The mystery of Mildred began for me then. When I was a teenager, my grandmother told me more. Mildred Harnack had grown up poor in Milwaukee, the daughter of an alcoholic, down-on-his-luck horse trader, and an independent-minded suffragette. The year Mildred turned 18, women won the right to vote, and her mother, who had a 10th-grade education, encouraged her to go to college. Mildred thrived at the University of Wisconsin, earning both a bachelor's and a master's degree. A week after receiving her diploma, she married Arvid, a German graduate student at UW who shared her passion for women's rights. Arvid shared her vision of the future, too. They would both get their doctorates and teach at universities. Mildred boarded a ship and crossed the Atlantic to Germany, where she enrolled in a PhD program and witnessed the meteoric rise in the popularity of a politician named Adolf Hitler. Mildred began holding secret meetings in her Berlin apartment to discuss strategies of opposition. The men and women Mildred and her husband recruited into their underground resistance group included students and professors, journalists and artists, office workers and factory workers. They were Jews, Catholics, and atheists. What united them was their hatred of Hitler. Mildred nicknamed the group the Circle. Over 8 years, the Circle intersected with three other underground resistance groups in Germany, forming an interlocking chain. Living in a fascist dictatorship, Mildred and her German co-conspirators understood the risks they faced. The Nazi government punished anyone who opposed it with prison sentences or death. In the fall of 1942, the Gestapo tracked them down. Charged with high treason, Mildred endured 5 months in prison and two trials at a military court. On Hitler's direct order, she was strapped to a guillotine and beheaded. Today, the book my grandmother gave me occupies the highest shelf of my bookcase. In this place of prominence, it reminds me that I have inherited not only a volume of Shakespeare's sonnets that once belonged to my great-great-aunt Mildred, but also a responsibility to tell her story. Researching Mildred's life consumed years of my life. When the pandemic hit, I was immersed in a series of notes I discovered in a German archive that women in her resistance group had written in prison. These notes, called Kassaber, were strictly prohibited. Guards were paid for each note they confiscated, and prisoners were punished severely if they were caught writing or passing them. Still, these women resistors took their chances. Sometimes they slipped notes to each other during their daily walk in the prison yard. Sometimes they concealed notes in the cracks and fissures of the prison walls, stuffing them into the crumbling mortar between bricks for other prisoners to find. As I pored over these notes, searching for clues about Mildred, sirens wailed outside my window. I lived near a hospital in Brooklyn that received a continuous stream of patients sick with COVID. On the rare occasions when I left my apartment, I saw sidewalks once bustling with pedestrians, eerily empty. The cafe where I bought my coffee closed. The diner where I met friends for breakfast went out of business. Many friends moved. I became aware of the absence of things rather than their presence. One morning, an enormous steel box on wheels appeared outside the hospital, a portable morgue. As the pandemic wore on, I found myself in a fugue state, wandering around my bedroom at 3 a.m. trying to conjure Mildred in her prison cell, trying to trace the contours of her emotional state as the wail of an air raid siren pierced her ears. I imagine collapsing the years between us. If I could reach back across three generations, I'd cut my hand around my ear, coaxing Mildred to whisper into it. When I managed to fall asleep, my dreams enacted vivid scenes of war. In the stark morning light, I was acutely aware that I could never know with any certainty what Mildred thought or felt shackled in her prison cell. Still, a sense of her shimmered from the letters she wrote during her first few years as an American graduate student in Berlin, when she saw Germany swiftly progress from democracy to fascist dictatorship. I read them over and over until her words etched into my mind. "The situation grows steadily worse," she wrote in 1932. "We must change the situation as soon as possible." My favorite photograph of Mildred shows her wearing loose-fitting pants and a button-down shirt rolled up at the sleeves. I sense a faint echo of my grandmother's face and the set of her jaw, the force of her gaze. Chin lifted, Mildred stares straight into the camera as if daring the person taking the photograph to stop her, as if saying, "Go ahead, try." Perhaps what I heard as a child, "You remind me of Mildred," suggested more than grandmotherly flattery. Perhaps it was my grandmother's aspiration for me. She hoped I would grow up and become the kind of woman who had the courage of her convictions, who spoke up and made herself heard, voicing her opinion even when it was unpopular or difficult or dangerous, who stood up to a bully even if many around her chose not to. After years of research, I know Mildred is remarkable but not unique. In every woman's family, there is an aunt or a great aunt or a great great aunt who has shown remarkable courage. We must claim that lineage. We must tell their stories. Our next article by Kate Kelly is titled "The Equal Rights Amendment Timeline." There are a lot of people who are under the mistaken assumption that the Equal Rights Amendment has been ratified and is now law. Not so. The ERA was first introduced in 1923, nearly 100 years ago, and was finally passed in 1972. But due to growing opposition by special interests and many Republican activists, as well as some legal technicalities, the ERA is still not ratified. We are, though, close to the finish line. Vocal support is vital, which is why we offer the short history of the ERA and the many benchmarks it has hit along its century-long journey. Let's bring this journey to a close. Meanwhile, here's what you need to know about its progress. July 19th and 20th, 1848. The first formal women's rights convention in America took place in Seneca Falls, New York, a town named after the neighboring Seneca, who were one of the six nations of the Iroquois. Convention planner Lucretia Mott had spent the month prior to the convention among the Seneca people and was inspired by the equal standing of Iroquois women in their society. Black abolitionist Frederick Douglass attended the convention and supported a resolution to include women's suffrage in its official platform. The resolution passed, and 68 women and 32 men signed the Declaration of Sentiments, which included universal suffrage in its demands. August 26, 1920. The 19th Amendment, granting women the constitutional right to vote, finally succeeded, due in large part to the militant suffrage tactics of Alice Paul, a fiery feminist from New Jersey. On August 18, 1920, Tennessee became the 36th and last state needed to ratify the 19th Amendment. Even when a constitutional amendment has met the requirements of Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution, it's not considered official until it has been certified by the appropriate government appointee. In 1920, that official was the U.S. Secretary of State Bainbridge Colby, who certified the amendment on August 26th. Today, the honor belongs to the National Archivist. Now, August 26th is celebrated as Women's Equality Day. 1921. After the 19th Amendment was ratified, Alice Paul said, "It is incredible to me that any woman should consider the fight for full equality won. It has just begun." Paul and other suffrage leaders, like Crystal Eastman, began to immediately organize for their next big move. They quickly settled on a plan to introduce another amendment to the U.S. Constitution to completely ban discrimination on the basis of sex. July 21, 1923. Alice Paul unveiled the Equal Rights Amendment in Seneca Falls, New York, at the 75th anniversary celebration of the first Women's Rights Convention. Paul saw this as the next logical step for those who had worked in the women's suffrage movement and named it the Lucretia Mott Amendment. That name, however, didn't stick, and it came to be known as the Equal Rights Amendment, or ERA. December 13, 1923. Representative Daniel Anthony, nephew of suffragist Susan B. Anthony, introduced the ERA in the U.S. House of Representatives, and Senator Charles Curtis introduced it in the Senate. The proposed amendment was introduced in Congress every year after that until it passed. June 30, 1966. Betty Friedan, author of The Feminine Mystique, and pioneering lawyer Pauli Murray, as well as 47 others, founded the National Organization for Women, or NOW. The original intention of the group was to be an NAACP for women. Alice Paul joined NOW and infiltrated the fledgling organization with older activists from her National Women's Party. Together, they persuaded NOW to take on the ERA as its major initiative. Frieden became convinced that by backing the ERA, NOW would forge the crucial generational link between the century-long battle for women's rights that was our past and the young women who are the future. June 11, 1970. Martha Wright Griffiths, a sharp congresswoman from Detroit, pulled a little-used congressional move and filed a discharge petition to force the ERA out of the Judiciary Committee, where it had been stuck for decades. Griffiths hounded other members of Congress for weeks to sign her petition and finally achieved the necessary 218th signature on July 20, 1970, forcing House leadership to bring the ERA to the floor for a vote. For her considerable tactical skill and passion for the amendment, Griffiths is known as the modern mother of the ERA. March 22, 1972. The Equal Rights Amendment was finally passed in Congress and sent to the states for ratification. The ERA was widely popular in the 1970s and was on the national platform of both major political parties. Due to the hard work of newly elected women like Representative Patsy Takamoto Mink, the first woman of color ever elected to Congress, the ERA passed by 354-24 in the House of Representatives and 84-8 in the Senate. It was immediately ratified by 22 of the necessary 38 states that first year. Due to the time difference, Representative Mink's state of Hawaii ratified the ERA the very same day it was passed in the U.S. Senate. March 22, 1972. Lamentably, in order to get the ERA through the U.S. Senate, proponents agreed to insert a time limit for ratification in the preamble of the amendment. When advocates rushed to find Alice Paul the day it passed in Congress, they found her at her desk weeping instead of celebrating. She saw the deadline as a poison pill attached by opponents to kill the ERA's chance at success. October 1972. By late 1972, the ERA was well on its way to becoming the 27th Amendment. Enter Phyllis Schlafly. Schlafly was looking for a way to make her mark on policy, since she couldn't get elected to Congress, and decided to start a movement called Stop ERA. The acronym meant Stop Taking Our Privileges, and argued counterintuitively that women would lose out under a system of constitutional equality. The Stop ERA movement used boogeyman arguments and extreme scare tactics to frighten women into opposing the ERA. September 1973. On May 14, 1973, up-and-coming feminist attorney Ruth Bader Ginsburg won her first case at the U.S. Supreme Court, Frontero v. Richardson. The court found for the first time that a law classifying benefits on the basis of gender violated the Constitution. In September of that same year, Ginsburg published a piece in the ABA Journal titled The Need for the Equal Rights Amendment. She wrote of the ERA, "The amendment looks toward a legal system in which each person will be judged on individual merit and not on the basis of an unalterable trait of birth." Ginsburg remained a lifelong supporter of the ERA, saying shortly before her death, "Every constitution in the world written since the year 1950, even Afghanistan, has the equivalent of an equal rights amendment, and we don't." November 18 to 21, 1977. Congresswoman Patsy Mink sponsored a bill that gave $5 million in federal money to hold women's conferences all over the country. The culminating national conference was held in Houston, November 18 to 21, 1977, and was attended by nearly 20,000 delegates and observers. Three first ladies, Rosalynn Carter, Betty Ford, and Lady Bird Johnson, as well as Coretta Scott King, headlined the Houston conference, and the ERA was reiterated as a part of the women's agenda. Delegates solidified a plan to seek an extension for ratification from Congress. July 9, 1978. The momentum of the Stop ERA movement had grown to a fever pitch, and the states left to ratify were very difficult places for women, mostly the Southern and the Mormon states with little women's rights infrastructure. Because of organized and well-funded opposition of the very vocal minority, ratification slowed to a halt, but supporters were undaunted. Over 100,000 people marched on Washington in support of extending the ERA ratification deadline, initially set to expire on March 29, 1979. It was the largest feminist gathering in the world up to that point. Eleanor Holmes Norton, then a young lawyer who was the head of the newly created Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, said at the march, "How will people look at us 50 years from now if Congress doesn't even give us more time? We will look back on history and wonder what all the fuss was about. The point of ERA is to get people to recognize that change is already here." October 5, 1978. After enormous public pressure, Congress voted, by a simple majority in each House, to extend the time limit for ratification by 3 years to June 30, 1982. Opponents of the ERA knew that 3 years was too short to oust intransient state senators who opposed the ERA in key states, and thus it would not be possible to seal the deal in that time frame. At the same time Congress voted to extend the time limit, the Senate defeated an amendment by Senator Jake Garn, a Republican from Utah, that would have legitimized actions by state legislatures attempting to retract their previous ratifications by a vote of 54 to 44. Though not technically necessary, President Carter went out to sign the resolution Congress had passed in order to show support for the ratification of the ERA. 1973 to 1979. In the wake of anti-ERA backlash, several states that had been enthusiastic ratifiers of the ERA just years prior began to attempt to rescind their ratifications. Idaho, Kentucky, Nebraska, Tennessee, and South Dakota. It has never been decided by the Supreme Court whether states can rescind a ratification once done, but there is clear precedent that these attempts are not valid. For example, with the 14th Amendment, Ohio and New Jersey attempted to rescind their ratifications, but they were nevertheless counted among the ratifying states. July 14th to 17th, 1980. In 1980, the year Ronald Reagan was elected president, the Republican Party ended its support for the ERA and removed it from its national platform. June 30th, 1982. On June 30, 1982, the extended deadline lapsed and the ERA stalled, just 3 states short of ratification. This came as a devastating blow to ERA activists who had worked tirelessly for decades to get it ratified, and they gathered in D.C. to mourn. Phyllis Schlafly, on the other hand, hosted an elaborate high-dollar banquet to revel in what she saw as the death of the ERA. Ronald Reagan sent her a congratulatory telegram. May 5, 1992. On this date, a new amendment was added to the U.S. Constitution, but it wasn't the ERA. The Madison Amendment, which limited the ability of Congress to give itself a pay raise, was ratified 202 years, 7 months, and 10 days after it was first passed in Congress. Ratification of the 27th Amendment, hundreds of years after it was first proposed by James Madison, revived hopes of diehard advocates that it was not too late for the ERA. They developed a 3-state strategy and began organizing to get the 3 final states needed to ratify it. June 27, 1994. U.S. Representative Rob Andrews of New Jersey, Alice Paul's home state, introduced a bill that would require the House of Representatives to take any legislative action necessary to verify the Equal Rights Amendment as part of the Constitution when 3 additional states ratified it. March 22, 2012. Carolyn Cook, D.C. coordinator for the Equal Rights Amendment Campaign Network and a Maryland resident, developed a specific strategy to remove the original deadline on the ERA through a new congressional resolution. Since Congress put it in, and a previous Congress cannot bind the actions of a future Congress, they can take it out, the argument went. Representative Robert Andrews of New Jersey introduced a bill to that effect and was joined in the Senate by Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. This bill was then carried on by Representative Jackie Speier of California in the House. That same year, Representative Carolyn Maloney of New York also introduced a start-over bill as a backup with Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey, should that become necessary. March 21, 2017. Given the tremendous energy behind the worldwide women's marches and under the leadership of queer black preacher Senator Pat Spearman, Nevada ratified the Equal Rights Amendment, the first state to do so in 40 years. The ratification reignited the battle to see the amendment ratified. May 30, 2018. Following the momentum in Nevada, Illinois became the 37th state to ratify the ERA. The effort was led by women of color, including Democratic member of the Illinois House of Representatives, Juliana Stratton, now Lieutenant Governor of Illinois. The ratification of Illinois left just one final state needed to meet the constitutional requirement for ratification. Several states had pending legislation to do just that, and it was a race to see which one would become the final state to push the ERA over the finish line. January 27, 2020. On this date, Virginia became the 38th and final state needed to ratify the ERA. Though properly ratified, having met all of the requirements under Article 5, the ERA still isn't officially part of the U.S. Constitution, because the U.S. National Archivist, David Ferriero, has not certified Virginia's ratification and published it in the Federal Register. As with the 19th and 27th Amendments, an amendment cannot be officially embedded in the Constitution until the appropriate governmental official certifies it. Just weeks before Virginia ratified, the Trump administration wrote a memo prohibiting the archivist from certifying the ERA because, they argued, the deadline had passed and the ERA was dead. The most recent three states to ratify, Nevada, Illinois, and Virginia, brought a lawsuit against the archivist to try and force him to certify it. March 17, 2021. The U.S. House passed a bill to eliminate the 1982 deadline on ERA ratification Congress originally put in and extended once already. This deadline elimination bill, sponsored by longtime ERA supporter Senator Ben Cardin, is now pending on the Senate side. The ERA can only be fully integrated into the U.S. Constitution once the deadline issue is settled, either in Congress or by the courts. Advocates argue that previous amendments, like the 19th, had no deadline attached to ratification, and that there similarly should be no deadline on equality now. Many argue that there is no additional action by Congress needed, and the archivist should certify it without delay. January 27, 2022. According to the third clause of the ERA, it becomes enactable 2 years after ratification. Therefore, January 27, 2022, the two-year anniversary of the Virginia ratification, should have been the day ERA became operable. On that day, President Biden issued a statement to mark the day saying, "I have been a strong supporter of the ERA ever since I first ran for the Senate as a 29-year-old. We must recognize the clear will of the American people and definitively enshrine the principle of gender equality in the Constitution. It is long past time that we put all doubt to rest. I am calling on Congress to act immediately to pass a resolution recognizing ratification of the ERA. Today, the status of the ERA remains in limbo until either Congress, the courts, or the archivists acts to solidify its validity as part of the Constitution." Today, the fight to get the ERA solidified as part of the U.S. Constitution continues. If you live in an unratified state, you can join a group in your area to push your legislature to ratify it. You can also find out if your federal representatives support the ERA and contact them voicing your support. Join and support groups like the ERA Coalition, Vote Equality, and Generation Ratify, which are actively organizing for the ERA. Our next article by Bonnie Swee is titled, "The Right Way to Learn from Your Mistakes." I can remember with aching clarity some of the most mortifying mistakes I've ever made. There was a sixth grade spelling bee, S-T-A-L, when spelling steel. In my head, I thought I had already said the E. The geographical error in the first edition of one of my books, I said Fort Mason was in Sausalito, but it's in San Francisco. A reader wrote in to excoriate my sloppiness. The time I left the car headlights on during a cold winter afternoon and returned an hour later to an engine that wouldn't start. In this case, I did the excoriating myself. We've all felt it. The forehead smack frustration that comes with failing, forgetting, or simply being flat out wrong. And to make matters worse, these errors tend to take center stage in our consciousness. Psychologists call it the negativity bias. Our minds are highly attuned to focus on what we've done wrong, not what we've done right. From an evolutionary perspective, it makes sense. For our hunting and gathering ancestors, messing up was often a matter of life or death. Though modern-day mistakes don't mean we're going to end up being mauled by a saber-toothed tiger, we may still respond with the same urge to flee. But that response leaves us ill-equipped to fix the kinds of errors we make these days, which usually require logical, methodical problem-solving. To err may be human, but we're still afraid to admit when we've been wrong. It feels like an indictment of our self-worth, says Kristen Neff, PhD, Associate Professor of Human Development and Culture at the University of Texas at Austin. This is unfortunate because, according to recent research, acknowledging our slip-ups is critical to recovering from them. When we make an error, most of us fall into one of two camps. Those who have a fixed mindset and think, screw it, I'll never be good at this, then try to shut out the mistake altogether. Or those who have a growth mindset and view an error as a wake-up call, identifying what went wrong and then adapting accordingly. It's easier for the wake-up call camp to get back on their feet, says psychologist Jason Moser, PhD, director of the Clinical Psychophysiology Lab at Michigan State University. Moser led a small study in which he recorded the neural activity of participants who completed a simple task that required them to identify a letter in the middle of different sequences. After the experiment, the researchers evaluated whether participants had a fixed or growth mindset. The growth mindset group made errors but quickly recovered. They showed enhanced brain activity on EEGs, indicating that they were focused on their mistakes and, as a result, were less likely to make a subsequent error. The fixed mindset group didn't show an enhanced neural response and were more likely to choose the wrong letter in the next sequence. By paying attention to mistakes, we invest more time and effort to correct them, says Moser. The result is that you make the mistake work for you. Fortunately, a growing body of research has found that we can rewire our response to mistakes so that they're not just scary, anxiety-inducing rabbit holes. The key? Self-compassion. Several studies show that when we practice a new way of approaching failure, it can change an error from something we fear into something we embrace, says Neff. The hardest part is giving yourself permission to relate to the mistake differently. One University of California Berkeley study published last year found that when a group of students failed a test, those who were reminded to be self-compassionate, with phrases like, try not to be too hard on yourself, or it's common for students to have difficulty with tests like these, were motivated to spend more time studying for the next exam, compared with students who were given statements meant to simply boost their self-esteem. You must be intelligent if you got into Berkeley. We found that people who were taught to be kind to themselves felt more motivated to see their mistakes as a chance for growth, says lead researcher Juliana Brines, PhD. Outside validation didn't seem to matter as much. Recently, an out-of-town friend texted to remind me when she was scheduled to arrive at my house, and I realized that I had completely forgotten I'd invited her. I spent the entire night anxiously wondering, how could I forget a person? I'm going crazy. But in the light of morning, I took a deep breath. I cleared my calendar, pushed up a work deadline, rescheduled some events, and apologized to those I had double-booked. Summoning Neff's wisdom, I tried to look at this error as a wake-up call to remind myself not to take on too much. And as Neff advised, I talked to myself from the perspective of a caring, problem-solving friend. Everybody has scheduling screw-ups. Build in more reminders next time. Let it go. Could I actually embrace the mistake? That seemed like a stretch, but for once, a singular oversight didn't feel like a black mark on my soul. I fixed what I could and stopped obsessing about the rest. No excoriation necessary. Our next article by Sarah Stillman Berger is titled, How to Stop Being Sad. Experts provide tips to help you ease past your short-term melancholy. It can come out of nowhere with no rhyme or reason, or it can follow a crushing breakup, the loss of someone special, or any other particularly tough time. It can slowly roll in like the dark clouds before a storm, or it can hit you suddenly without any warning. Whatever form it comes in, sadness is something we all experience, and yet it can still be incredibly difficult to get past. But here's the thing. You can learn how to stop being sad. While some tried-and-true methods require you to dig deep, other ways to beat the blues are incredibly simple, like spending more time outside, watching a show that's practically guaranteed to make you laugh, and yes, crying your eyes out. No, spending all day on the couch with a pint of Chunky Monkey in one hand and your favorite glass of red in the other is not a scientifically proven technique for letting go of sadness, unfortunately. One thing to note, if you're still feeling upset after a period of 2 weeks, and if you notice any other symptoms, like loss of energy, trouble concentrating, or difficulty sleeping, you should reach out to a professional for help. Ahead, psychologists and mental health experts share their top tips for how to stop feeling sad regardless of your triggers. First, don't feel bad about feeling sad. When something negative happens in your life, it can seem like your world is ending. But instead of suppressing or dismissing your emotions, either by distracting yourself or keeping up a good front, you should actually embrace them. All emotions are important to experience and have valuable information for us about our lives, says Dr. Lori Rockmore, PsyD. In fact, a 2017 study published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology concluded individuals who accept rather than judge their mental experiences may attain better psychological health, in part because acceptance helps them experience less negative emotion in response to stressors. Instead of beating yourself up for feeling down, try to consider this as an opportunity to learn, grow, and find true healing, says Brianna Borton, CEO of the wellness organization Dragon Tree. Can't pinpoint why you're sad? Try writing. Sometimes it's easy to pinpoint the reason you feel upset. Say if you just can't get over your ex, you bombed your big work presentation, or you had a major fight with your partner. But at other times, you may be sad for no discernible reason. When this is the case, grab a pen and a piece of paper and write without stopping for 5 minutes or longer, suggests life coach Sunny Joy McMillan. Not only may you naturally uncover what's causing your sadness, but just the act of writing may help you start to feel better, something that's backed by numerous studies. Alternatively, you could also try keeping a journal, taking a yoga class, or meditating, all of which are great ways to focus on your inner self. Embrace your emotions. As we mentioned earlier, when you avoid sadness altogether, you're actually doing more harm than good. You can't heal what you don't feel, says life coach and author Nancy Levin. As uncomfortable as it may be, acknowledging and embracing your sadness is actually the first step to feeling better. Instead of running away or eating something or drinking something or yelling at someone, breathe it in, Tibetan Buddhist nun and author Pema Chodron told Oprah during an episode of Super Soul Sunday. No matter how bad it feels, you just give it more space. When you breathe in, you open to it. To release sad emotions, don't overlook the value in a good cry. Alternatively, you could also try crashing, which is something Levin does when she's sad. I put on music or movies or shows that I know will help me cry, and I have a release, she says. While it may seem counterintuitive, Levin is actually onto something. Only humans exhibit emotional crying, says Dr. Matt Bellis, PhD, psychologist, and self-help author. And not to get too sciencey, but Bellis says a biochemical analysis of tears found that the droplets contain an endorphin named leucine enkephalin, which is known to reduce pain and improve mood. Plus, according to a study published in Frontiers in Psychology, crying is associated with the activation of the parasympathetic nervous system, which stimulates a relaxation response, meaning it may have a self-soothing effect on people. Equally important, the same study found that criers most likely report mood improvement if they receive comfort from others, so it may be helpful to let it out in front of a close friend or family member. Now, here's how to move on. Once you've ugly cried until your eyes burn, it's time to get a grip on things. It could take a few days, a few weeks, or even a few months. Grief doesn't live on a timeline, says Levin. But you can't stay in a dark hole forever. Here's how to crawl out. Set the bar ridiculously low. To ensure that you don't go from 0 to 100 and back to 0 again, lay the groundwork for success by initiating action in the smallest possible increment, suggests McMillan. Start by doing something simple, like brushing your teeth or washing your face, and then continue taking small incremental steps, say making coffee or putting on a clean, cozy sweatsuit. Once you get moving, you may be surprised that you feel inspired to do more, she says. Find what does make you happy and laugh. Consider this the opposite of crashing. Instead of embracing weepy tearjerkers, pick out an uplifting read, put on some happy tunes, or watch a few feel-good films, suggests McMillan. Alternatively, you could engage in an activity or a hobby you truly enjoy, whether that's volunteering, working on a challenging jigsaw puzzle, or attending to your lush gardens. Even better, doing something that'll make you laugh. Think listening to a comedy podcast or even watching a cat video on YouTube. Laughing in response to pain and sadness can be a terrific coping mechanism, says Bellis, adding, laughter releases endorphins similar to exercise, reduces the stress hormone cortisol, and increases dopamine, aka the feel-good hormone. Of course, the grieving process takes time, so there's no shame in not wanting to laugh for a while, assures Bellis. Spend time in nature. Rockmore recommends experiencing the outdoors with all five of your senses, which she calls behavioral activation. Pay attention to what you see, feel, hear, smell, and possibly taste in nature, and it may help you out of your slump. Getting out of hibernation and being active stimulates the nervous system and gives people the opportunity to see beauty in the world, says Rockmore. Don't have time for a 6-mile hike? According to a 2019 study, spending 120 minutes a week, or just over 17 minutes per day, exploring your local park or walking around your neighborhood can greatly enhance your overall sense of well-being. Seek help if you think you may be dealing with depression. If your sadness goes beyond the blues, your sleeping patterns and eating habits change, you're not interested in activities you used to enjoy, you have trouble concentrating or making decisions, it may mean it's more than just sadness. And while self-help books are a good tool, you may find that talking to a therapist, even if it's through an online platform, is helpful. If you are considering self-harm, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or text HOME, H-O-M-E, to 741-741, the crisis text line. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.